sister, what a waste to see you in this place. I lose my mind from worrying over you.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Diane Greenwood, author of the new novel about the Carlton sisters from She Writes Press. After studying both writing and counseling psychology in San Francisco, Diane now lives and writes here in Portland and works as a family therapist, which seems like an ideal job for a fiction writer. Diane has published essays in the online magazine The Big Smoke and is a contributor to the anthology 2020, The Year of the Asterisk, from University of Hell Press. About the Carlton Sisters is Diane's debut novel, a book she's been working on for the past 25 years. Diane is now 81, with three more novels in the pipeline. Author Renee Denfeld writes, "In Turns Tender and Wise, About the Carlton Sisters is an exploration of sisterly love." Diane Greenwood writes into the heart of sibling bonds, telling a story of three sisters in their mother's final days. These characters are complex, real, and dealing with transgressions that might break them apart or bring them together. This is a touching, tender book that will appeal to readers of all ages. Please join us for our conversation with Diane Greenwood, which is already in progress. Well, Diane, thanks for joining us today live in the KBOO studio. So nice to see you in person.
Well, thank you, Ken. This is a real honor to be able to be here with you.
The honor is mine. I wanted to start with the family. You do such a good job of writing the entire Carlton family. So there's three sisters, Lorraine, Julie, and Becky, in descending order of age. Dottie, their mother, and their father, Tom Carlton, their absent father.
Right.
And you've said your own family was, quote, fairly dysfunctional. Did you draw from your own relationships with your parents and siblings for the book at all?
That's a very interesting question, Ken. I think what is common across really all of the novels that I write is the emotional landscape is one that's very well known to me. And I say that not only in my own family of origin, but also in working as a therapist with families. I mean, families don't come to you for treatment unless there are problems. And it's usually stems from an inability of all things to communicate, to both listen to each other and to hear more deeply than just what's on the surface.
And I think that's true with a lot of families, even the ones you don't see
exactly
as part of your practice.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So in my own family, I was talking about this in Seattle. There was kind of a no-talk rule at the dining table, and part of it was because my father, according to my mother, worked very hard all day. He did. He was a retail clerk working in grocery stores, and when he came home, whether it was for lunch, which we did as a family in South Dakota, or he came home for dinner, my mother would always say, "Now, your father needs quiet. He needs to relax with his meal. So I think it would be best if we don't talk." I think that's why I became a writer. I wanted
you
to
had
talk.
Everything pent up over so many years as,
yeah,
as
right.
a young woman, a young
yeah.
girl.
Yeah. I needed to speak my mind, and I wasn't exactly the easiest child for my mother, because I was the eldest of five, and I asked way too many questions.
I got into trouble myself, not so much with the family, but in school.
Okay.
For asking questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a shame. I mean, I still ask questions. I don't get into trouble so much, but
right. It
seems that that's something you'd want to encourage a child to do more of.
Well, because it comes from a place of curiosity.
Yes, that's how they learn.
Mm-hmm. And she was a Libra, so the sign of the scales. And she needed to keep everything on an even keel, even though, you know, my dad was an alcoholic. And he wasn't cruel, but he had a hair trigger temper. And so all of her efforts went into keeping him happy so that that trigger didn't get triggered.
So you have some personal experience with
yes.
that. And I was going to ask you, related to that, you work as a family therapist in,
yes.
in Portland. And I read that when you were studying for your marriage and family therapy degree, you specialized in addictive processes. And did you pick that as a specialized field because of your childhood and your experience with people who were dependent?
I think it had a lot to do with it, Ken. I know my mother died quite prematurely by today's standards when she was 60. And she died of colon cancer. And my internist at the time, I think I was right on the cusp of 40, told me that she probably had that cancer growing in her for a very long time. And
Undetected.
And she never went to the doctor and she never complained. It was that post-depression era. But I think that what happened was shortly after she died, my father got sober. And that was so dramatic to me that she had to die in order for him to get into treatment. And he stayed sober until he died at 75.
It was such a traumatic event for him and so shocking that he was able to change his behavior.
Well, he went into a downhill spiral, and then my only brother, did an intervention and got him into treatment and saved his life, really.
So you saw how effective treatment
yes,
could be.
Yes, I did. And I have my own history. You know, I was a problem drinker until I was in my mid-40s. So I've been sober now for nearly 35 years.
A lot of the clients you see, do they have addictions like that, alcohol?
It used
drugs?
To be true. The last time I worked in treatment was 2012, and I worked in Astoria for a residential treatment center. And there I was working primarily with late teen, early 20-year-old men. Most of them were addicted to heroin. And it was some of the most challenging and some of the most rewarding work I ever did.
Well, that's extremely difficult because that's physically addicting. And
yes.
From what I've read,
yes.
you get very, very sick when you're withdrawing
yes.
from the drug.
Yes, without medical, and even with medical intervention. Heroin withdrawal isn't going to kill you like alcohol might, but it's very painful. So I felt I had a measure of luck. Part of it was because of my maturity and my years of experience. But I also had a key question that I had learned to ask these individuals over the years, and one that they would tell me repeatedly they'd never been asked. And that was, I just simply asked them, what was happening in your life when you were 5 to 7 years old?
Well, as simple as that.
Yeah, who was there for you? Who cared?
Uh-huh.
Who could you count on? And so much of the time they said there was no one there. Even if their parents were intact in the family, they were emotionally unavailable. And it is often the beginning of this pool of emotional pain that we carry with us until we die.
And the alcohol, the heroin, whatever the addiction is a way of tampering
yes,
that.
Yes. It's all, I still see it, it's all about pain. It's all about emotional pain and not feeling loved or cared about. I think that's why AA has been so successful, because it's all about creating community, a community you can count on, where people before in your life you might not have been able to count on, or you felt somehow estranged.
Yes, you're going to the meetings, you're meeting the same people, you're assigned a sponsor, right? Becky makes use of her sponsor.
Right. Kind of on, off again.
Right, calls her a few times during the course of the story.
Right. Yeah.
It just seemed, when I read that you were a family therapist, it seems almost an ideal job for a novelist, because you're learning about people. I mean, there's not too many people you can just walk up on the street or meet, or even friends, and say, between the ages of 5 and 7, your question.
Right.
What do you remember? Was there anybody there to care for you?
Yeah.
It's a very intimate question, which you can do as a family therapist, but not necessarily as a friend or...
Right. Yeah.
Just making small talk.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not a question that you would even ask your family members. I can't imagine asking my sisters that.
Right.
Yeah.
And yet integral to this book and probably a lot of your writing career.
Right.
That knowledge that you gain from the clients and the experiences you have as a therapist.
Yeah. I think it's made a tremendous difference. And the truth is, Ken, it's all about story. We all have our story. But finding somebody who will listen to it, who will empathize with what didn't work for you, who can recognize those places where you might have fallen down and help you explore them enough to bring you back up again. So it's been very satisfying work. I have been so fortunate to be a novelist and to be a family therapist. I couldn't have imagined a better life.
I want to get more into the novel part now.
Okay.
We've talked a lot about the family therapist now, but it just seemed just a perfect profession, occupation for a writer. And you've been writing for many years, even
yes.
though this is your debut novel. You studied with two very prominent writing teachers, Janet Fitch in San Diego when you lived there, and Tom Spanbauer here in Portland. He
right.
has the somewhat famous Dangerous Writers Workshop
right.
that graduated people like Chuck Palahniuk, and you had mentioned Susie Vitello was
yeah.
in there,
right.
Monica Drake,
uh-huh.
and
Cheryl Strayed.
Yeah, Cheryl Strayed was a dangerous writer.
Uh-huh.
Can you talk about them a little, Janet and Tom, and maybe their approaches to writing fiction and how that influenced your own work?
Well, Janet's approach was very much a very sensory approach. If you've ever had the opportunity to read her novels, particularly her two Russian novels.
What's the one, White?
White Oleander.
Oleander, yes, I read that one.
Right. She's not afraid of unlikable characters. She has a way of delving into the psychological structure of those characters. And then also really making the landscape another character in her novel.
I have a question about that for you, because your landscape here is definitely a character in the novel, a fictional
yes.
town called River's End in
yeah.
Central California Valley. So you got some of that from Janet? From
I think I did get a lot of that from Janet. What I learned from Tom is I really think I learned how to write from Tom. I learned how to take risks with characters. I shied away from the nice characters, or we wouldn't have a Becky. I learned more about the importance of a sentence that stands on its own. His style wasn't nearly as expansive as maybe Janet's was. But as I look back over my career of working with both of them, I don't know that my style is like either one. What I have recognized much later is that the tone of my novels is more like that of Raymond Carver.
Ah.
Which makes sense, because he wrote about alcoholics.
And working people.
And working people.
And that's who these characters are in small town.
And that's who I always write about, mm-hmm. are working people. And, of course, that's what Tom wrote about, was working people. So I think maybe he gave me a greater appreciation for that, too.
Now, you started writing the book about the Carlton sisters, I think about 25 years ago.
I did.
Do you remember how the idea first came to you? What got you excited to put it down on the page?
Well, I think there were two things that happened. One was that my sister Peggy and I were attending some 12-step meeting. It might have been Adult Children of Alcoholics. And as she began to talk about our family, I suddenly had the realization we'd grown up in two different families.
Her perspective was very different than yours.
So different from mine. Very different.
I wonder if that's why you have the chapters narrated from the perspective of each sister.
Absolutely.
Not necessarily sequentially or alternating, but each one has a say in there and it's first person point of view.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why. Because if you think about the novel, you know, Becky has big issues around abandonment.
Yes, her father left her.
Right.
Well, left the family, but she took it more personally.
Yeah, and then later in the novel, she accuses Julie of leaving her. Julie escaped. She wanted a larger life, and she had been training in classical ballet, and she just didn't want to get stuck in a small town. Whereas Lorraine, who was the first character I actually wrote,
I think that's also part of the origin story of the book, right? The Lorraine character?
Yes.
I think you tell the story, I should let you tell it, where you had a writing retreat and you went out into the woods and she just appeared to you?
She did. She appeared out of nowhere. I have this happen a lot, Ken. And she was in her pink waitress uniform. She was in this dingy diner on Highway 99 that was owned by Diego, who was the head cook, and she'd been there for 30 years.
And you were seeing all this just on a walk in the woods, huh?
Yeah. So there's a strange thing that happens for me. I don't know if it happens for other writers, but when I get my eye fixed on a character, it's like there's a movie camera that begins to roll in my head. And within a very short period of time, I know the emotional landscape of this character. And I could so relate to Lorraine because I was the eldest of five.
And were you the responsible one?
I was responsible to a fault. My siblings hated me because I was so bossy.
Very Lorraine-ish.
Very Lorraine-ish. Yeah, she was so easy to write, and Becky was easy to write, and Becky was fun to write. Julie was the hardest. I just somehow could not pull up from inside myself that 6-foot blonde, always so aware of how she appeared, gorgeous.
Did you compare in the book to Olivia Newton-John, one of the characters?
Yes, it is. I do compare her.
If listeners want to get a picture in their head.
Right, right. But I spent a lot of time in Las Vegas talking to showgirls, and she began to form herself. And she's maybe a little bit more detached emotionally from this family drama because she has lived away and she's lived a larger life.
Now, before we leave the subject of the origin of the book, I got to tell you, there's at least two writers you know who have said this exact same thing to me. One of them is Lydia Yuknovich, who can see her characters and even talk with them and hear them. And the other was the wonderful writer, Renee Denfeld, who was your host.
I didn't know that about Renee.
Yeah, in fact, Renee told me her first book. She works as an investigator during the day, trying to, get people off certain long sentences or capital punishment. And she was returning from some facility, might have been a prison, and she was in her car and she saw, just as if he was really there, a character right next to her, shoddy clothes, his bare feet were up on her dashboard. And that led to her first novel.
What a great story, Ken, because
you've got to ask her.
Well, I will, because I have read that novel over and over.
And that was The Enchanted.
The Enchanted.
Yeah, and I did interview her for the second one, The Butterfly Girl,
okay.
which was the sequel to it, the follow-up. Yeah. But yeah. She said that experience is not unusual for her. And Liddy was telling me that she also has kind of a synesthesia where music, she'll see colors, she'll see things. And as a child, it was a problem. But as an adult writer, it's a blessing.
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, when I was in San Diego, my writing pal of 35 years, Judy Reeves, we were in the car driving one day and I said, "Oh, I think the next one is Tina. T-E-E-N-A. She's 70-something years old. She's working in Mission Valley in one of those old 60s motels as a motel maid. But she has this long history that she's never revealed to anybody." Anyhow, it was just an idea.
And it just came to you.
But Tina was just right there, fully formed. And I'm working on a novel now called Bert and Eileen. And Eileen was there from the beginning on the train traveling to Pendleton with her poor husband who's going into alcohol treatment.
What a gift.
Oh, it is. And the thing is, it makes writing fun.
And also, you know, you're not going crazy.
Right.
You're not alone.
Right.
There's other writers.
Well, now I know these other writers, yes.
Yeah, maybe if I had something like that, I might hesitate to tell other people. They might say, "Well, there's something wrong with you." But I would say, no, I think they're... might be something wrong with you because you don't have that ability.
Well, the unions.
Almost a superpower.
Yeah, the unions would say you're just really close to the archetypes, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I do feel that. I do feel that, you know, because also of all the personal work I've done. So there's no shame in pulling up these down and out characters.
Because you went through some of that yourself.
Yes.
Especially
yes.
when you got sober about 45 yeah. years ago.
And just to support myself as a writer, when I think of all the jobs I've done, you know, it's amazing to me.
Now, I want to get back to the town itself.
Okay.
Which we said is almost like a character in the book because it's so well rendered. It takes place in the Carlton sisters' hometown. This is a fictional town, River's End. California Central Valley. There's a few clues in the book. It's about a few hours drive from Fresno. And it's on Highway 99. It's on the Tuolumne River in the book, but that doesn't make sense geographically from when I looked at a map. So you might have taken a few liberties there. But I was wondering why you had a fictional town and not a real town. I should also mention Julie's description of the town here, just to give listeners another taste. River's End is no vacation spot, just a place where there's mountains to the east and west and a valley between, stringing telephone lines together. An aqueduct heading to L.A. Most folks can't even tell you where it is if they've heard of River's End at all. Like mothballs and damp basements, it reeks of the 50s the same way our Third Street house did, which is a great description. So why is River's End? And as you mentioned, you grew up, I think, in both North and South Dakota.
Well, I was born in North Dakota and lived there during World War II. And then as soon as the war was over, my father moved us to Western South Dakota, which is where I grew up until I was 15.
So this is a very different location here.
Very different
Central
location.
Central Valley, there's almond orchards there.
Yes.
Other than that, it's fairly hot, barren, not a lot around.
And yet, you know, most of South Dakota's like that.
Ah.
Minus the orchards.
Right.
No orchards.
They don't have the California agriculture.
Right. And, you know, they grow mostly wheat and corn. But there was a very practical reason for this too, Ken. I needed a town that was close enough to Las Vegas that putting Julie on a bus between Las Vegas and this fictitious town wouldn't take more than 7 or 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to have her on a bus. I had an agent at one time, and she wanted me to put her in a plane. And I thought, no, that would be a whole different story.
Definitely, because she meets a very important character.
Yes, she does.
On the bus, and probably not a way you would meet somebody on a plane.
Exactly. Yeah, especially someone who finally admits he's afraid of flying. Yeah.
And also given their class and their economic, their financial circumstances, the bus makes a lot more sense.
Well, and Julie was trying to save a few bucks.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, coming home. Yeah, her mother is dying of cancer when she comes home from Las Vegas. And each of the Carlton sisters, you mentioned some bad characters, but I think what struck me most about the book is there's good and bad in every character in the book. There's no all good. You can make a case for Arthur, the person that Julie meets on the bus ride. But other than that, each sister, of course, the mother and the father, Dottie and Tom Carlton, all have some very sympathetic sides to them and some really nasty stuff.
Deep flaws.
Yeah, deep flaws is a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
Lorraine, we mentioned she's kind of the straight-laced one, religious.
Yes.
She's chummy with a pastor there.
Yes.
So religious in that sense, trying to keep everybody in line. Julie's the dancer. She wanted to be a ballerina. She ended up in Las Vegas dancing, so still somewhat fulfilled her ambition. And Becky wanted a home and family too, but most of all, she wants her father back.
Yes.
She really longs for him. And she also desires her mother's diamond wedding ring that her dad gave her because it connects Becky to her dad, who's gone now. Were some of these situations and relationships taken from your own experience too, both maybe as a therapist, but also as the elder sibling in a family? Again, what struck me, not just the three-dimensional part of the characters, but they were so different from each other. Mm-hmm. And yet they were sisters, same blood, same mother, same father.
So sometimes birth order will do that, Ken. Mm-hmm. It's very common for the eldest to try to be the family hero and to be the responsible one. And Lorraine was perfect because she she stayed in this dead-end job for 30 years, no benefits, just what she could save. And then just like she had waited for her boyfriend for 15 years to marry her. And now she's enamored with her pastor. Julie, the second, often the second in the family will be.
I should mention just about 2 years separates your sister.
Yes. She was, she fulfilled being a little bit more rebellious. Often that second one in the family feels like they can't compete with the eldest, so they're going to forge their own path. And sometimes...
She got out of town.
Yeah, she got out of town. Yeah, she did. But she also had the advantage of having the mentoring of her dance teacher, who helped her understand there was a bigger life out there. And then Becky just got lost in the shuffle. You know, her dad abandoned the family when she was still fairly young. She was his favorite, which is established in that little excerpt that's right at the beginning of
the
book.
Yeah, the prologue where it's like a flashback to 1955. So about 44 years before the present day of the novel, 1999 in River's End.
Yeah. And so, she felt she could get away with anything with him because he was her advocate.
Right.
And then when he went away and her sisters were in high school and getting ready to launch their own lives, she was kind of left in the dust. And it's revealed why. Later in the novel.
Yes, there are several secrets that get revealed here, long buried secrets that explain a lot. Now, you say quite a bit about families in the book too, Diane. There's one line I love from Candy, who's Becky's AA sponsor. She says, "Families are as dangerous as bars," which is certainly true here. Your bars, you can get drunk and make a fool of yourself, but the family is a little tough. Yeah, you'll be sober the next day and you'll be outside of the bar, but the family you've got forever. Which brings me to the next line I really loved, and this is Julie saying it later in the novel. "Not that I'm an expert on families, but to me, families are like a Venus flytrap. Only entrance, no escape." And then I kept saying, well, Diane must know. She's a family therapist. She's probably seen this over and over again, but you depict it so well in the book.
Well, there's a theory in psychology in that our families are the constellation that's moving around us. But there's a way in which we internalize those family members, particularly mom and dad. And I have contemporaries who, in our, what my native teacher used to call the third, on this third hill of life, are still ruled by some of the shortcomings of their parents.
And third hill of life is at a certain age?
It's the last hill of life.
Okay.
That was where those statements came from, especially with Julie. We never, ever leave the subtext of the family drama behind us.
As hard as some of us try.
And sometimes, you know, all the new work that's been done with trauma, sometimes it's carried from one generation to the next. So I noticed my own parents traumatized by growing up during the Depression, how that carried on into their lives, and then how it carried on into my life. Always being conscious of, you know, saving, of being careful about not being frivolous with money. And yet I have two adult sons who have kind of gone the opposite direction.
Kids will do that, huh?
And yeah, what I noticed, particularly in one, what's that old saying, penny wise and pound foolish? You know, if it's something that he wants, that it's extravagant, then it's okay. But then he'll pinch pennies in other ways. It's very fascinating.
So kind of almost a reaction against the way you were brought up.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So human beings are forever interesting, Ken.
I know that.
We'll never run out of characters.
When I was reading the book, I happen to be listening to a podcast. Mark Maron has a podcast, WTF. The F stands for something I cannot say on KBOO on the air, but many people will know it. It's been around a long time. But his guest, and this was a recording, so went back to 2019, was Brené Brown, who you probably know as a therapist.
Right.
She's not a therapist, but she's a professor and researcher in social services.
Right.
So she kind of mines the same ground in a way. And she was talking in the interview about codependency, and she said it's usually driven by selfishness, a need to stop the other person, the one dependent on whatever addiction, drugs or alcohol, from behaving that way because it's scary for this person. She said for real empathy to replace that selfishness, the codependent would have to know where they end and the other person begins. Mm-hmm. And that was something I started thinking about. I thought you captured that well there, especially if I can just give an example with the relationship between the older sister, Lorraine, and the youngest sister, Becky, who's an alcoholic. They were so close as sisters, and they can only view the other sisters as extensions of themselves mm-hmm. in a way, not separate and very different people. I wondered if that resonated with you as a writer and or a therapist.
I think with both. There's a style that often happens in what we call dysfunctional families that is called enmeshment. And it's related to codependency, that whole concept where, yes, your boundaries between, you know, who I am and who you are become very hazy. Codependency is actually, I would rather treat an alcoholic any day
than
a codependent, because they always look good. They're always nice people. But it's really hard to discern that all of that behavior is really about trying to be loved by you. So they will almost kind of blend into, become part of the other person.
And that might be what Brené Brown was getting at, where they would need to see themselves as separate individuals.
Yeah.
On a much smaller scale, I had that with my kids, my two sons. They're very different personalities, maybe birth order. And I have to see them as humans now, separate from me. And that's always been difficult as a parent.
I think it is difficult. I don't know why I can say it was difficult and not difficult for me. As the mother of sons, and I was alone a lot of the time, I'm practical to a fault, like my mother. And it was, you know, they graduate high school, then they have to move to the next phase. There was no coming back home and lying on the couch and watching TV. If you wanted to do that, you had to get a job and pay me rent. So they both, of course, left immediately and went to the University of Washington.
A better alternative.
A better alternative. Yeah, where they could, you know, they could have their independence and do their, you know, that kind of matriculation when you're trying to be an adult and you don't quite know how to do it.
But the very important...
It's very important.
That step of leaving the nest.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Now, another thing in that Brené Brown interview, and also I saw this in the book, she started talking about forgiveness, which is a big subject for her. And she's written several popular books. She did at least two TED Talks, and I think she even had a Netflix series on her research. It's difficult for each of the sisters in the book, whether it's forgiving their mother, their father, or each other. And what Brené Brown said was that in order to forgive, something has to die. Mm. Until then, she said, there's usually only anger and resentment, which we certainly see in the book. And she feels, as I think Buddhists do, and I know you are a big fan of Pema Chodron.
Yes.
And her writings on Tibetan Buddhism, that in order for forgiveness to happen, we have to feel pain and suffering. I think that's also the basis of Christianity in a way,
right?
With Jesus. And I see it in the novel. There's so much anger in the book, but also grief and loss and the pain that results from that as the story unfolds. Was that a conscious decision as a therapist writing these characters in order for them to forgive and to have any chance at a reconciliation? They would have to go through the mill here. You know, you couldn't do it easy.
Yes. The book originally ended in a different place. And it ended in a place where Lorraine had to kind of sit in the loneliness and grief that she had caused to her family. And my developmental editor, who is Susie Vitello, said, we cannot stop there.
What was Susie's reasoning? That it was difficult for the reader to stop
there? I think it would have been too hard for the reader. And to have the reader walk away from the story and have that be the last note that they walked away with. So after Susie told me that, when you've worked on a novel for a long time, Ken, you know these characters. I know these sisters almost better than I know my own. And so there was a natural segue that I had built in that I used. And what is more of a place of possible reconciliation than a family dinner? And so I wrote the dinner. And it was so interesting to me just how it unfolded. It almost unfolded intuitively.
Once you got Susie's feedback.
Once I got the feedback and I could wrap my mind around it and say, she's absolutely right. You know, I can't leave the novel there where I originally intended it. And so I was really happy with the ending.
I am too.
Okay.
But again, I don't think we'll give any more details there because I think that's part of the reading pleasure, the experience. Uh-huh. Now, I managed to get this far, Diane, without asking specifically about your age, but that must have been on your mind while writing the book over all those years, giving you a different perspective on the characters than, say, a younger author mm-hmm. might have. You have Julie comment on her mother, who's in her 80s and dying of cancer. Quote, "It wasn't fair. You survive your whole life to end up emaciated and repulsive to the touch. You can't bear to see yourself in the mirror, let alone have anyone else look at you." And 2 pages later, again from Julie, she says, "In the end, this is where we all go, a land of withered fruit and dry winds that suck the tears and sweat out of us." That's so nice and lyrical. I like that. "Cold that's just below the skin, where the blood has slowed to a trickle, and there will never again be enough warmth to rekindle whatever fire was there before for Dottie, for me, for any of us." Mm. It's kind of her "alas, poor Yorick" moment, like Hamlet in the graveyard.
Right.
Do you have those thoughts of mortality maybe informing the writer, especially when imagining the end of a long life? Again, something a younger writer would just not be attuned to.
Right.
For the most part. Maybe some of them are.
Right. It's interesting that it came from Julie.
The second of the three sisters.
The second of the three sisters. The glamour girl, the one who had depended on her appearance to open doors for her.
Uh-huh.
But for myself personally, I probably sound like Brené Brown. I have so much gratitude for the life I've been able to live. And except for a few achy breakies we all get, I do not, whatever that number means, 81, it feels like a number to me.
I'm the same way. As I get older, I just, whatever age I am, I think, boy, you know, about 20 years ago, I thought that was like senility. You know, your next step was the grave. You had, you had a few days left to live. But when you reach that stage, you tend not to feel that way. Or I hope most people don't.
Well, I know some people who do, but that's just not been my experience. I think part of it, Ken, is because I've been able to live my dreams. You know, I think people who feel they've missed out, and I think part of this is informed by my own family. My blessed mother, and she was had the best heart, but she always talked about wanting to go to Hawaii, which, you know, for most of us, that's a small dream. But she always wanted to go to Hawaii, and she never got there.
Oh, that's sad.
And I think her aging process set off such warning bells for me that I have really paid attention. I think since I was in my mid-30s, when I quit smoking, and then 10 years later quit drinking, I watched her growing old at 35. And I thought that's what happened to you. But it isn't.
Doesn't
what
have
happened.
To.
No.
Right.
No. Life is rich and full, and there's more adventure to be had, you know? And it's unpredictable. We don't know what's coming next.
The only constant is change.
Right. Right.
Again, Buddhist concept.
Yes.
Well, they're not alone in thinking.
And impermanence.
Right.
You know, there's a wonderful quote by Chekhov. I wish I had it. It was, I read it in a novel, but it's, you know, just a mere matter of a few years from now, none of who we were or what we did will really matter, you know?
Yes, that's so kind of the big view of our...
Well, it is.
And our part in the universe.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, you better live your dream now because nobody else is going to live it for you.
Has somewhat achieving your dream, publishing your novel, which I guess is kind of like if your mother was visiting Hawaii after working on it for so many years, had that made you more accepting of your own mortality, maybe given you some peace that you accomplished such a challenging goal, one very dear to you for much of your life?
Yeah. Well, I think it has. I have 3 more novels, Ken.
Yes, I have that listed here. That's amazing. Forever Blackbirds. a sequel, Safekeeping, and then the one you mentioned, Bird and Eileen, where Eileen kind of came to you,
right,
you know, very graphically in your mind.
Right. And those will begin to be released next year. Gigi Little has already done the cover on Blackbirds.
Ah, my very favorite cover designer, Gigi.
Oh, she just did a magnificent job on this. And the sequel, Safekeeping, will follow shortly thereafter. And then Bert and Eileen will hopefully come within the next year and a half. Here's where aging has come in. Just as we were going into the pandemic, I was on the cusp of 78 or 79. And I said, you know, I'd gone through the agent routine. I'd gone through so many rejections. And I said, if it's going to happen, it has to happen now. And that was when I discovered She Writes Press. And I've had a wonderful experience with them. But as a self-supporting woman, I can't afford to keep going there. So these novels will come out under the imprint of Traveler's Moon Press.
Oh, great. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, which is my own imprint.
Yes, but you're in the independent press business.
Yes.
And I can tell you, I think the very best books come out on independent press. And
well, thank you, Ken.
We have some great ones here in Portland.
Yeah.
Well, Laura Stanfill.
Yes.
Forest Avenue Press.
That's a fabulous press.
Yeah,
yes.
Hawthorne Books.
Tin House
Future
is here.
Tin House.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been very
Perfect
fortunate.
Day Publishing, Microcosm Publishing.
Yes.
Yes, just very rich here in independent press.
Yeah,
and
we're lucky.
And writers.
To be in Portland.
Well, I'm lucky you came in to talk with me today, Diane. I'm very fortunate and grateful to you. Thank you so much. I love the novel and I'm looking forward to the next three.
Thank you, Ken. My pleasure.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it if we had one, you can listen anytime on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, Jonesy, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Diane Greenwood, author of the new novel about the Carlton sisters from She Writes Press. Diane will be appearing at Portland's Annie Bloom's Books tonight, Thursday, August 10th at 7 p.m., and at Portland's Broadway Books on Tuesday, September 12th at 6 p.m. You can learn more about Diane, her work, and all her upcoming events online at dianegreenwood.com. That's Diane without the E, D-I-A-N, Greenwood.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, August 24th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
your eyes are filled with tears. Sis, let's get out of here. 'Cause I love you, baby sister. Let's go home. 'Cause I love you, baby sister. Let's go home.